Hi, I'm Hampton Sides. I'm the author of The Wide, Wide Sea.
Author Hampton Sides is an American historian with many best-selling works of narrative history and literary nonfiction. His latest book follows the third and final voyage of Captain James Cook. The voyages of Captain Cook have inspired many in the arts: Coleridge's The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, Herman Melville's Moby Dick, and even the character Captain James T. Kirk of the USS Enterprise. And they've led to a canceling of sorts by the indigenous peoples of the lands Cook quote-unquote discovered. I recently spoke with Hampton Sides about all of this. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Hampton Sides. Okay, so talk to me about Captain James Cook and his three odysseys. I mean, what was it about Captain Cook that captured your attention?
Well, Captain Cook is one of those commanders, one of those navigators who pops up everywhere you go in the world. He's sort of like a jack in the box. It almost becomes a question of where didn't he go, particularly when it comes to the Pacific Ocean. And I've been aware of him for a long time, but I couldn't figure out how you crack this giant subject and break it down into a narrative, the kind of narrative I like to write. Yes, he had these three monumental voyages around the world, but I decided to write about just one of those voyages, his final voyage, which was his longest voyage, both in terms of duration and nautical miles, but I think also his most dramatic of his odysseys for a lot of reasons, including and especially because it ends up in Hawaii, a place that he, although he did not discover Hawaii, we have to acknowledge that the Polynesians did that. He was certainly the first European discoverer. And he ends up, I think it's pretty well known, and it's not a spoiler for me to say, that he ends up dying in Hawaii. And it's a very, very graphic, very, very violent, rather spectacular end of his life and end of his voyage there on the shores of the big island of Hawaii. So I just thought, you know, this is the way to tell the story of Captain Cook, not cradle to grave, massive biography, not looking at all three of his voyages, but really focusing on that third voyage. I had a ball doing it. I spent 5 years traveling all over the world, just trying to go to as many of his anchorages as I could, especially spending a lot of time in Hawaii. And now, admittedly, these are not difficult places, most of them, Tahiti and New Zealand and Hawaii. But I travel around the world in pursuit of this story and had a ball doing it.
So I found his skill as a cartographer interesting. You described early in the book a description of an elegant and painstaking map of Newfoundland, and that when it's compared against satellite images, his precision was remarkable. Talk to me about his skill as a map maker.
Right. I think his skill at making maps, and particularly mapping shorelines with the kind of crude tools that they had to work with way back then, we're talking about the 1700s, you know, he didn't have GPS and he didn't have all the kind of tools that surveyors have today, but they were incredibly accurate. For example, he fairly cursorily, fairly quickly circumnavigated both the North and South Islands of New Zealand on his earlier voyages and came out with this map that is just ridiculous. I mean, it's ridiculously accurate. It's almost chillingly accurate when you compare it with satellite images. Also, when he was a young man, he mapped, as you mentioned, the coastline of Newfoundland, which is incredibly intricate and complex. And he's doing this with trigonometry, with dead reckoning, rarely coming ashore. He's out in the water where there's fog and heavy seas. And somehow he comes up with these incredibly accurate maps. And certainly the Admiralty and the Royal Navy recognize this skill. It's a skill that's really based on a lot of his meticulousness, of course, but also astronomy. He's an incredible astronomer, kind of amateur astronomer, using the stars and the planets and the sun and the movements thereof to figure out where he is in the world. So the Admiralty understands this and elevates him, you know, very quickly through the ranks of the Royal Navy. Turns out he's also really good at commanding a ship. He's turns out to be a great leader. These Men on Cook's third voyage had many of them had been on his first and second voyage. He seems to be able to inspire that kind of loyalty that few captains back then could inspire. He cared about his men. He was very, very conscious of ship hygiene. So many people died on these voyages during the age of exploration, and yet Cook had an amazing track record. Not a single man died of scurvy on any of his three voyages. He was rather methodical and scientific about everything he did on these voyages. And so, including observing, that's the other thing that's amazing about Cook for me is that he, even though he has no training as an ethnographer or anthropologist, he's observing these cultures and in a really kind of objective way, I think a very fair-minded way. So we get these incredible reports coming from his voyages of these first encounters with people all over the Pacific, which is incredible for his time.
So talk to me about scurvy, because I found it comical just how many different practices that the men of this time would think, oh, this is going to help with scurvy. And talk to me about what they tried and what actually works.
Okay, so scurvy, of course, was just this horrible malady that affected all long-distance voyaging. It seemed to be an occupational hazard that the navies of Europe were willing to tolerate. It, as many as half the people on board the ship might die of this horrible disease, which causes your body to just absolutely disintegrate from within. You basically just sort of turn to mush. It's just horrible. This is a horrible thing. Of course, we now know that it's caused by a deficiency of vitamin C. But then the scientists and the leading thinkers and the doctors really didn't know that. They didn't understand what it was. Some didn't even think it had anything to do with diet, that it must have something to do with the atmospheres on board these ships or some kind of going back to the idea of humors, some kind of different imbalance in your humors. They tried weird dietary things as well, all kinds of ingredients that Cook experimented with on board. But what Cook did seem to understand was that it had something to do with eating fresh food. That salt pork diet with the hardtack biscuits that sailors were eating on these long voyages was bad. He understood that. And he, almost against their will, he made his men eat fresh vegetables, fresh fruit, berries. Sometimes they just cut a bunch of grass and boil it and make some kind of soup out of it. It didn't seem to matter what it was. And he certainly never exactly figured it out. But that fresh food is what saved all these men's lives. I mean, it was almost like, eat your vegetables. They didn't really want to eat this stuff, but he made them and it did save their lives. And so when he got back to England, the Admiralty hailed him as the conqueror of scurvy. He didn't exactly conquer it. It would take another several more generations before they really fully figured it out and started, demanding that people drink lime juice. And this is why British sailors are known as limeys. So that took a little bit longer to nail down. But Cook was certainly a pioneer in this field.
Talk to me about Mai.
So Mai is a major character in the book, a major character in the voyage. He is the first Polynesian to set foot on English soil. And he had been brought back, this young man from Tahiti had been brought back to England as part of Cook's second voyage around the world. When he got to England, he became a superstar. I mean, just a celebrity. People loved this young man. He had this infectious kind of good cheer, and he was willing to learn all about English society. He learned to speak English. He learned to hunt at the estates of the aristocracy. He met King George III and all the sort of intelligentsia of London. He was paraded around in places like the Royal Society of London. He met Boswell and Johnson and, all the leading lights. He was also a big hit with the ladies. People thought he was exotic and intriguing, good-looking guy. Basically paraded around England as a kind of the paragon of the noble savage. I put that in quotes, noble savage. But people were intrigued by, this question of whether, can a native person have, some sort of nobility? Maybe they aren't tutored in the same way we are, but they're tutored by nature. And then, there's all these philosophers who are trying to weigh in on the subject. My is loving this whole experience up to a point, though. But then he gets homesick. He wants to go back to Tahiti, where his family is, and where he has his own agenda, which is that he wants to go back and prosecute a war against the people of Bora Bora, who had stolen his family's land and killed his father. And he wants to bring back English muskets and all kinds of ammo. And it's almost like a Hatfields and McCoys type thing. He wants to go back and fight this war. It's really the reason he came to England in the first place. So King George III decides that, yes, England owes it to this young man to get him back home, which is, it's getting him back home. I mean, you have to understand, it's on the other side of the planet. It's 2 full years of sailing to get him there. Captain Cook becomes the guy who will transport Mai back to his home islands. And it all becomes this story of cross-pollination and cross-cultural influence. Like, by the time he gets back to Tahiti, he's no longer really fully Tahitian, and he's not exactly English. He's a citizen of the world, but he kind of belongs nowhere. He has all of these possessions that he's accumulated in England, and he doesn't really know what to do with himself anymore. It's kind of a bittersweet story, I think, about what happens when you take someone out of their environment and show them the world in this way. But it is a major part of the book, and I was looking from the very start in doing this project. I was looking for an important Polynesian character, and man, did I find him in the person of Mai. Just before he left England, he was painted by the very best portrait painter in London, Sir Joshua Reynolds. And that painting, Portrait of Omai, was recently sold to the Getty Museum in London for $62 million. It's considered his masterpiece. So Mai, in some ways, is still famous to this day.
Yeah, it was sad, his confused state of identity, and how when he did finally get back to Tahiti with all of his goods, his fellow countrymen didn't really want to give him the time of day until he produced this currency of red feathers. Can you talk to us about that?
Yes, earlier in the voyage, before they got to Tahiti, Cook and his men were able to obtain this huge trove of red feathers that turned out when they got to Tahiti, this was like worth its weight in gold. It was this other kind of currency. The Tahitians were really interested in iron, anything metal, but they were particularly interested in these red feathers, and I couldn't really exactly figure out why. It was it's something about the color red coming from these rare birds from Tonga. This was the color of the gods. This was part of something called the cult of Oro, which was one of the Tahitian gods. It was strange, and Cook himself couldn't believe how valuable these little feathers were. I mean, it was just like he wished he'd procured three times as much, because it was you could buy an entire pig for one feather. That's how valuable these little feathers were considered on the voyage. So it's kind of amazing. And everywhere Cook goes, even up into Alaska, he's trying to figure out what to barter with. What do people found valuable? And other places, metal was not considered that special, or the feathers didn't do anything in Alaska. But boy, in Tahiti, man, they were just that was like, just like all worth all the treasure in the world.
I want to talk about an instance that happened between the men of Cook's expedition and the Maori people. So, of the Maori, Cook said, "I have always found them of a brave, noble, open, and benevolent disposition, but they are a people that will never put up with an insult if they have the opportunity to resent it." So, what happened on Cook's second voyage and then when he went back on his third?
So on Cook's second voyage, there were two ships, and they got separated from one another. And so this was the sister vessel, the consort vessel of Cook's ship, that stopped in New Zealand on the South Island, got into a conflict with the local Maori warriors, in which these 10 men were surrounded, were attacked, were killed, and were consumed. Yes, a cannibalistic ritual that was part of the Maori warrior tradition of, you know, sort of imbibing the spirit of your enemy. And Cook, on his third voyage, having heard all about this incident, decided he needed to go back to the scene of the crime, find out what really happened, to investigate it. It's almost like he becomes a homicide detective. He goes around interviewing people, taking all kinds of notes. And, you know, this is a piece of unfinished business that he feels he needs to resolve. And finally, after compiling all his notes, he decides that his own men had caused this conflict. It was their own fault. There was a particular hothead who had it sounded like to him that it had caused this whole thing. And almost like they deserved it. And as far as the cannibalism part of it, Cook didn't care about that at all. He's like, well, this is what they do in their culture. This is how their warrior society works. What difference does it make what happened to their flesh after they're dead? This is the way Cook thinks. You know, it's like back in England, this would be considered the most reprehensible taboo, you know, eating the flesh of your countrymen. Cook has this kind of moral relativism or something where he says, no, this is what they do here. We're not going to superimpose English morals on this. And he ends up ultimately forgiving the Maori and even inviting one of the ringleaders of the massacre, if you want to call it that, onto the ship, where he's given gifts and even painted by Cook's expedition artist. So this really irritates Cook's own men. They can't believe that he has forgiven the Maori for this heinous episode. And it also confuses the Maori, because the Maori thought Cook had come there to avenge the crime, to retaliate in some way against the Maori. And here he is forgiving them. So they don't understand that kind of in their culture. They, you know, every act requires sort of an equal and opposite reaction. And Cook resisted that. So I don't know, it says something very interesting about Cook's personality, his sort of objectivity. It ends up being a turning point in the voyage, though, because after that, Cook, you will not see that sort of relatively lenient Captain Cook anymore. He becomes more and more judgmental and quicker to exact punishment on both his own men and native tribes that he encounters along the way.
You know, I had looked at some of the images that were included in the book, and so I knew that part was coming, and because I can get kind of squeamish. But when we got to the part of when we were at Tahiti and it was two and he was trying to, I think there might have been a threat of war from Moorea, and so he decided there needed to be a human sacrifice, and Cook decided he was going to watch it. There was an audible gasp for me. And then when he got to eat the eyeball, I had to stop reading that chapter and I went on to the next. So don't ask me what happened at the end of there, because I didn't read it.
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of little plots and subplots in this book and episodes like that. You just can't believe it. And Cook is appalled by it. He thinks it's just the height of superstition, and he thinks it's really just stupid. He tells the chief that he thinks that. He doesn't think that the human sacrifice is going to do any good. It's going to only just anger the gods, he says. At the same time, there he is scribbling in his notebook, taking notes, observing. He really feels that it's his responsibility to witness this thing and to describe it and report on it and not pass too much judgment on it. That's the proto-anthropologist in him. He has to put on different hats at different points in the voyage, but he seems to enjoy this role of, I don't know what you want to call it, ethnographer, or, you know, just taking down the rituals and the ceremonies and trying to accurately and objectively describe them.
So there were some curiosities that I noted as I read along, like the Earl of Sandwich and his relation to the modern day sandwich, or the arrival of barbecue in Great Britain, or the fact that Bligh, who had the most storied mutiny in history, was on at least one of Cook's expeditions. But then there are some other curiosities that I actually want you to comment on. So Cook's orders, if you will, were to discover a Northwest Passage. And when he finally revealed the secret of the mission to his crew, he offered them an exchange for grog. What is grog, and how did he get his men to agree to forego it?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the many roles that Cook had to play was kind of negotiator, let's just say, with his own men to keep their morale up and make sure that they didn't run out of certain things too early in the voyage. So grog was, you know, this sacred substance that the sailors lived by and swore by. They had to have their grog. It's basically rum mixed with water. They get a certain ration of it every day. Cook started to realize that they had a long way to go on this voyage. They were in Tahiti and they had to get to Alaska. And he realized they were going to run out of the grog if they kept drinking it. So he said, basically, let's stop drinking the grog now and postpone any consumption of it until we get to where we're going. And this is when he unveils to them, we're going to Alaska, essentially Alaska. They didn't call it that then. It's going to be cold. It's going to be miserable. It's going to be, you know, we're going to be in and out of the ice floes. Grog is going to be your friend then. So let's stop drinking now and just enjoy the other creature comforts here in Tahiti, this very pleasant place. And to everyone's surprise, the men completely agreed and voted unanimously, yes, let's postpone the grog because we got so many other nice things here in Tahiti. We'll save it for Alaska. So that, I think the show is a little something about Cook's ability to, you know, think about the welfare of his own men and sort of include them in the decision-making process, something that most captains of that day never did. It was, you know, they were tyrants. They were master and commander of the ship and all decisions flowed through one man. Cook didn't do as much of that on the third voyage, but this was one example where he did. It was a really good decision that he made, and everyone was behind him 100%.
What is the K-1?
The K-1 is a little device about the size of an abalone shell. It's essentially a seagoing clock, but it is a very, very important tool in navigation. It's something called a chronometer. It's something that was the product of many decades of experimentation and thought and theorizing, and then also manufacture, because they had to figure out how to build a seagoing clock that could withstand all the different atmospheric pressures and thunks and shocks and knocks of an ocean-going voyage. And what the K-1 did, it was designed by a guy named Kendall, so it's the K-1. It basically told the time as long as it was wound every day, it showed the time at an agreed-upon reference location, in this case, Greenwich, England. And if you knew the time in Greenwich, England, and compared it with noon wherever you were in the world, through a fairly simple set of calculations, they could tell longitude. And longitude was this very hard thing to ascertain. Latitude was easier and had already been established long before that. So now you have longitude and latitude, you know exactly where you are in the world. For the first time, and Cook's second and third voyages, he had the benefit of this little tool. He knew where he was. And prior to that, it was always an approximation. You know, with a lot of observation of the stars and the moon and the sun, you could guess where you were, but it was very inaccurate. It's very murky. So now Cook's able to, in anywhere he is, he knows where he is. His maps are more accurate because of it. When he reports back to the Admiralty, you know, these maps that make it home, they show exactly where these islands are for the first time. And it's really one of the reasons Cook is a little bit controversial today among native Polynesians, because he essentially broadcast the location, the secret location of all these islands all over the world, and put them on maps that were published. And that accelerated the whole process of colonization. But the K-1 is a very important tool. You can see it at the Greenwich Museum, the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich. And these tools are amazing. And just a tiny little thing. I was sort of like the iPhone or something, you know, the iPad, just a little tool that changed the world.
In your author's note, you write that Cook has become a symbol of colonization and the ravages that came with European arrival. And you later wrote that it was also true that Cook had an admirable habit of affixing an indigenous name when he definitively learned of one to his charts. I mean, I found it funny later that in Alaska, he failed to give a significant waterway a name just writing the word river. But you wrote that in the third Odyssey, Cook was starting to realize that visiting these islanders wasn't good for them. And I know in your note you wrote that you neither lionize, demonize, nor defend him. But after all of your research, what do you make of the current controversy?
I have to say that I admire Captain Cook for so many of his qualities. I do think he belongs in the pantheon of the greatest explorers of all time, just by the sheer number of miles he traveled and the quality of his reports and his observations and the accuracy of his maps. There's no question about his competence and his, I want to say, genius in sort of understanding the contours of the world. And any one of his voyages would have put him in that pantheon, but he had three of them. So there's that. At the same time, I do think I tried to sort of bring in a modern sensibility and try to understand the assumptions and the goals of these expeditions. It wasn't just about pure exploration. It was about imperialism. It was about a handful of European countries who are playing this enormous chess game to carve up the planet and find these lands and claim them and exploit those resources. Even though Captain Cook was an explorer first and foremost, of course he understood he was participating in this larger game that had horrible consequences for these very fragile island communities. So even though it's not really exactly what Cook himself did, it was really what his voyages set in motion that came later, immediately after him, that is really truly the devastating thing. Here comes armies and navies and the germs and alcohol and the problem of money and, which devastated their economies. The missionaries come and rewire their societies. All of this came later. But Captain Cook is viewed as kind of the one who started the whole thing. So his statues are coming down. They're being vandalized, toppled into the sea. Mainly, again, it's not exactly what he did. It's what he set in motion, because you have to find a place first before you start to ruin it. He wasn't really the ruiner, if that's a word, but he was the finder.
One can glean from the epigraph that the title, The Wide, Wide Sea, comes from Samuel Coleridge's The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And you wrote that Cook's voyages inspired Coleridge and even Melville, who wrote about a wide and distant sea. Is it true that he was also the inspiration for Captain James T. Kirk of the USS Enterprise?
Well, it's widely thought that he was. You have Captain James Cook, you have Captain James Kirk. Certainly, there is an element when you watch Star Trek. It was very similar to what Cook's voyages were like, in the sense that he would just go from island to island to island. And it was like as if he had gone to another planet. These different cultures speaking different languages, having different, cultural traits and habits. He comes in peace, but he is also there to sort of scientifically document, who these people are. And, there are a lot of similarities. And it is widely thought that the creators of Star Trek were directly patterning the show after Cook's incredible voyages. Cook's voyages became the subject of best-selling novels and poems and operas and plays and, artwork, part of the iconography of Europe in the age of exploration. Everybody knew who he was. He was a household name all over Europe. Really was someone who I think was widely lionized all over the world until this sort of more recent reckoning started to happen. I would say it started really in the 1960s and has progressed since then. And now, like I say, he's been canceled, but he's certainly been reassessed, particularly in Polynesia. The iconography, the statues and the paintings are coming down and mothballed. But I don't necessarily think it's all fair. I do think sometimes I think they've picked the wrong guy to be mad at, because what you really see Cook, at least at his best, is a true explorer. Someone who, where he's most animated, where he's most intrigued, is when he's called upon to explore and describe something entirely new animals, new plants, new peoples that that Europeans had never seen before, and to describe them and sort of spread the knowledge of the world. So, you know, I think he's viewed himself very much as a figure of the Enlightenment. The idea that knowledge is good, the idea that we need to cross-pollinate and understand each other across the great voids of the ocean. That's Cook at his best right there, I think.
What do you hope readers will take away from The Wide, Wide Sea?
Well, I think what I really try to do in my books is to bring readers back to that time and sort of peel away the layers of things we now, of course, think differently about all kinds of things, thank God, but put you in that time period and let that sort of experience. It's like going back in a time machine. I hope I've done my job and sort of putting you on those two vessels, the Resolution and the Discovery, and make you a member of this voyage. All the hardships, all the difficulties, the majesty of discovering something new, the weird experiences, the madness along the way. I feel like, you know, if I've done my job, you, the reader, has gone on a voyage to all these places right alongside Cook and his men.
Well, the book is The Wide, Wide Sea. Hampton Sides, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great, great. It's been a real pleasure.
That was Hampton Sides, author of the book The Wide, Wide Sea, Imperial Ambition, First Contact, and the Fateful Final Voyage of Captain James Cook, which was published by Doubleday. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning. And our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia. And for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.